Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Drew Chacon, and he'll be answering your most important questions on top saltwater flies. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Drew a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of the broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Drew Chacon about top saltwater flies. Looking for that shot eddy permit? Whipray Key Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island and are only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipray Key is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placentia. Once you're there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and you won't be taking long boat rides to get started. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for a tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit WhiprayKeyFishingLodge.com. That's Whipray, C-A-Y-E, FishingLodge.com. Before we introduce Drew, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. In our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1 year membership to Fly Fishers International and a 1 year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Drew's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Drew's book, Featherbrain, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Featherbrain is a book about developing, testing, and improving saltwater fly patterns. So if you're interested in winning that book, here's how you can win. Be the first person to answer the question or questions. Sometimes I do two-part questions we ask at the end of the show. And they will be about something that Drew and I talk about during the show. Submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. It's the same place that you can ask questions at during the show, so the same form. So listen closely and take good notes. Be quick about it, and maybe you'll win Drew's book, Featherbrain. Our guest tonight is Drew Chacon. Drew is an author, award-winning outdoor writer and fly designer, photographer, lecturer, and materials expert whose passion for teaching and the art of fly tying has inspired numerous how-to articles, books, and detailed instructional guides. He has lived and breathed the sport since he was tall enough to sit at the vise, and his fly creations are well-known and in high demand among saltwater anglers and guides across the globe. Drew has been a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and commercial fly tire for more than a decade. He's a designer for Umpqua Feather Merchants, and his patterns are sold in quality fly shops and have appeared in over 70 U.S. and international publications. He is the winner of the 2016 and 2017 International Fly Tackle Dealer Best in Show Saltwater Fly Pattern Award, as well as in 2014 the IFTD Iron Fly. At the beginning of 2018, Drew partnered with Wild River Press Books to publish three new titles, Top Saltwater Flies, Bonefish, Tarpon, and Permit. It's a three-volume set. It's the largest tying instruction series on the subject ever published. Other books that Drew has written and published have been Featherbrain, Developing, Testing, and Improving Saltwater Fly Patterns, Baby Tarpon Flies, Redfish Flies, Snook Flies, Essential Bonefish Flies, and Essential Permit Patterns. So lots of writing and work done there. In addition to his ongoing work as an educator, Drew ties premium saltwater flies for sale through his company, Salty Fly Tying. And he's the co-founder of Strip Strike University and frequently hosts destination schools and fishing adventures anywhere saltwater species swim. Drew is an ambassador for the American Museum of Fly Fishing, Patagonia, G. Loomis, Mustad, Dynaking, Bodhi Paddleboards, Loon Outdoors, Whiting Farms, and holds pro staff positions for Nautilus, Reels, Airflow, as well as many other premium fly fishing manufacturers. Drew, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it'll be fun. We've got lots to talk about. You've done a lot of writing, a lot of books on tying. That's quite the list of titles I read off. Huh?
Yeah, I never would have described myself as a writer in high school or college. I don't know how that all happened, but it did.
Okay. Drew, are you on a speakerphone?
I am, yep.
Okay, well, get closer or pick it up, one of the two for me.
Sure.
So I can get, you sound a little far away now.
Is that better?
Much better, much better. Okay, good. We want to make sure we get a good recording. Good. Okay,
sure.
So, you know, I'm keying in because Tom Perreault was nice enough to send me some review copies of your three latest books, which I've read through cover to cover, all three, believe it or not. And there's just a bunch of good stuff on fly tying in there. And so I'm hoping to just kind of skim through and find some juicy nuggets here and there and talk to you about the whys and the wherefores and the hows of how things are done and kind of, you know, fill people in on your techniques and get them excited about tying saltwater patterns. So sound good?
Sounds great. Fire away.
Okay. All righty. So I'm starting out with your Bonefish book, and again, these are the books from Wild River Press. And on our website, you'll see a link to that right on our homepage. On the right-hand side, you'll see Top Saltwater Flies Bonefish. You can click on that, and it'll take you right to a website where you can order those books if you'd like, as well as the other books down below, which are available through Amazon. You can click on those links and get any of Drew's books there. So lots of books to browse and investigate. So anyway,
if you want a signed copy, they're all on my website too, and most of them are in digital format as well. If you're more into the iPad thing.
Yeah. Okay. And
SaltyFlyTying.com.
Right, and I think we have that on your bio page. A link to your website there too, where people can find that. Good. So first off, you spent a lot of time in your book talking about vices, and you kind of over the years tried many vices and narrowed it down to one. You want to tell us about the vice you use and the why
sure.
is behind it?
Yeah, absolutely. I tie on a Dynaking Professional. Like you mentioned, I've tried an awful lot of them over the years. And for tying a lot of flies with a wide range of hook sizes for saltwater, you know, sometimes bonefish I'm tying eights, or sometimes for, I don't know, Louisiana redfish, it might be on a 3-aught or a 4-aught. You just need a vise that has a wide range of capacity for the jaws. And I like the notch jaws on the Dynaking. So as you do apply a lot of thread pressure, the hook's not sliding out of the jaws or popping or anything like that. So I've never found a vise that holds a hook, no matter what size you come up with, more firmly than a Dynaking. I like the Professional because it's the way it's set up. It's a true rotary, but the way it's set up, it's, you know, it's perpendicular, if that makes sense. It's like a T. So It makes it so you can lash it down, if you will, with the C clamp to the bench and get a lot of stability with it. It's not like a curved vise, or it doesn't have another hinge point in the neck of the vise, if you will. So once you get the hook in there and clamp it down, nothing's going to slide loose when you're really cranking out flies.
And that works for all those sizes, from, like you say, 6 to 2 or 3, 4 aughts.
Yeah, I don't know how big. I've taught, like, I think I've tied up on, like, 8 aughts, you know.
Oh, really?
yeah, one of my buddies, Oliver, was doing some GTs in Oman, and he needed some, you know, double X or triple X wire on ADOS, and I was amazed how well, you know, I was able to you know, I mean, I had some doubt, but when I finally got it, the vise opened up, it held it just fine. So if that doesn't speak volumes, I don't know what does.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have to change the jaws at all? It's all the same?
No, you just like, you know, back off the thread on the front of the jaws, and it opens it up, and, you know, it's definitely machine grade. I mean, it's solid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with other vices, I've been in, you know, tying classes where, you know, an inexperienced tire wasn't really sure what they were doing, and they had the tension wrong on the jaws. And I've seen, I won't, you know, name names, but I've seen vices explode and the jaws shoot across the room. You know, you're sitting at a bench or a table with, you know, a couple dozen youngsters, and a piece of metal goes flying by their heads. Moms grab kids and take them out of the class pretty quick. So,
yeah,
you gotta be careful with that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, or they just don't hold. You know, you put a vise in there and you crank a hook in the vise and you crank it down as hard as you can, and you put your thumb on the eye of the hook and push down, it just slides out of the vise.
Yeah. You'll
never do that with a Dynaking.
Cool. Yeah, well, that sounds like a good recommendation. And as much as you tie, I'm sure, put it through its, work. So, good.
I've sent the same one back a couple of times to get oiled up, but she's still going.
She's still going, same one, wow. That's a lot to be said for Dynaking. Yeah, great. The other thing that struck me is your, and of course, this is new since, you know, I mean, well, not new, but in the past 10 years, LED lighting has really come on to play and everywhere. I just installed two reading lights by our bed yesterday, little LEDs. And so you found that those LEDs are great lighting for tying as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm almost 40 now, and the eyes have taken some abuse. So I have two sets of the dual LEDs above my vise. I like them because I can directionalize where the light is depending on what I'm doing, and they're plenty bright. Everyone says if they're plenty bright, why do you need two sets? But you know, the more the merrier for me because I'm sitting in front of a vise most of the time. So, but they're amazing. I can't recommend them enough.
Where did you get those? Where are they available from?
They're through Hairline. Hairline Dubbins.
Oh, Hairline?
Any store that stocks Hairline products can order them for you. Any fly shop, where I'm sure you can do Amazon and find them right on Amazon. It's, you know, I've recommended them to numerous people. So if anybody has any questions, shoot me an email.
Yeah.
Drew at Salty Fly Tying, and I'll send you a link to them if you can't find them. But yeah, they're fantastic.
Okay. All right. Another thing that we use quite often, it looks like, and in a lot of the patterns, is a good old dog brush, right?
Yeah. You know, that's one of my essential tools. Whether you're doing dubbing brushes or, you know, just palmering any material, really, it helps keep things from being trapped under consecutive thread wraps or wraps with the material. I carry them with me all the time. When I'm fishing, I leave one in my bag just because after a few fish, flies tend to get kind of slimy, and it kind of corrects all the fibers and brings everything back to unclogged up or unglobbed up, if you will. So yeah, I use a dog brush every day. The the small ones. Enrico Puglisi has some on his site, I think. Still, they're like a 1-inch finger brush, and those are great for, you know, when you're on the water or traveling. If you can't, you know, find those smaller wood ones like I have in the book, but yeah, any of those multi wire like square headed, you know, dog brush, they work great.
Yeah, my wife gets after the cat with one of those all the time because it gets the under fur out. Yeah. So very familiar
with
that.
It works way better than like a standard like comb. Some people say, oh, use it like an eyebrow comb or a mustache comb, but it just, it doesn't work as well.
Cool. And you use the smallest one that you can find basically out there? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, you only need an inch or two across the top of the head on those brushes. And like I said, those little EP ones are cool because you can, you know, you have to reverse them when you put them in your pocket. Otherwise, they chew the heck out of your leg if you're on the boat or whatever. But
yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. But, yeah, they work great. Smallest one you can get.
The other thing caught my eye is you spend a lot of time talking about dubbing spinners. So you want to tell us about your experience there, because that seems to be a tool you're using quite often as well.
Yeah, so a dubbing loop allows you to trap fibers and palmer them much like you would a feather, so you can create cylindrical shapes and then, you know, trim away hairs. I use it a lot for doing like collars on tarpon flies with rabbit hair, or I use the, like for my coyote ugly shrimp, I'll make a dubbing loop with coyote hair and then trim it tight to make the body. What you need, though, is to expedite that spinning of the two legs of the loop as fast as you can so all the hairs don't fall out. And, you know, it's kind of a balancing act to keep the hairs in the loop and the loop taut so they don't come out. So, you know, Loon just came out with their dubbing twister, which I really like because you can kind of hold the loop tight with your left hand and then spin the weighted, I think it's the spinner with your dominant hand, your right hand, and that gets on it real quick. Before that, I use just a modified paper clip, you know, to spin it by hand, like kind of like old crank, you know, hand crank drill, to tighten it up. And that way I can still use the rotary feature of my vise and palmer the loop, you know, while I was stroking back the fibers, you know, that wrapped forward. You know, there's a lot of them on the market that are really thin wire. And if you try to make a turn with the dubbing spinner, you know, the loop intact, you end up ripping the wires off, and then the whole thing turns into what looks like cat vomit on your lap. But in my opinion, it's another one of those tools that I can't live without. So whenever I'm tying or traveling, I always have a couple of them with me.
Okay. And but that Loon, what, Outdoors Gator Grip double spinner?
Yeah.
Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the one I prefer. There's a couple attachments for it. There's like a clip, and then there it looks like a cup hook, and the cup hook is the one that I prefer.
Okay.
You know, it's very short, so if you're tying with your vise on a bench and not hanging off the bench on like a C clamp, what you run into with a longer tool is it rests on the bench and you lose thread tension. So it's important to have a shorter tool if you're, you know, if you're tying on a pedestal rather than the C-clamp.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, because I see there's a picture in your book here of you tying, and you're tying off the bench.
Yeah, I have an extension that goes below the bench just to cut down on shoulder fatigue. It more puts the vise, like, in your lap, so your arms in a natural position. You know, you put a 9-inch pedestal vise up on a bench, and then you're finding that after a couple hours you get really bad neck pain and shoulder because your arms are above your head for a couple hours while you're working. So if you do a lot of time, that's a really good tip, is to get the vise lower and closer to you so your arms aren't stretched out.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing you feature in here is E6000 glue. Industrial strength adhesive.
probably the best glue I've ever found for keeping things put and never coming off again, especially, you know, dowel eyes for like bait fish flies. That's probably the question I get the most, is what glue do you use for gluing on eyes? And, it's, great stuff. I would suggest that you do it in a well-ventilated area when you're using, when you're, you know, applying that stuff, because it is kind of noxious. It's strong stuff. But, man, it, when we were in Argentina, we had a problem with the piranhas, and they would eat down to a bear shank a hook, and I have a bag of flies. It's kind of a joke. There was nothing on the fly except for a couple of fibers of yak hair and the two eyeballs that were still glued to the shank of the hook.
So there's a good testimonial right there.
Yeah, they do not come off. They sell the stuff in a couple of different sizes. I think they make a couple different applicator tips. I would suggest going with the travel minis, I think they call them. There's 6 or 8 or something in a pack. And the reason I say that is for the amount you're using the stuff, if you get the big tube, it has a tendency to dry out. So if you can use it in smaller quantities, it stays, I guess, fresher longer. And it also has a smaller applicator tip. So when you give it a minor squeeze, you don't have a quarter-sized glob of the stuff sitting on your bench.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you get this stuff?
I do like Michaels or Joann Fabrics, but again,
oh, okay, yeah,
you can find it on Amazon.
Okay,
The clear is the one you want.
Yeah, clear. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, yeah, and another thing I thought it was cool here is you talked about a battery powered trimmer, you know, for mustaches and stuff, and
yeah.
That keyed me in. I go, you know, I used to have a beard, a goatee, and I had a trimmer, and I clean shaven now. So I go, dang, I can use that trimmer for something now, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been sitting in the bottom of a drawer for a long time, and I never thought about using it for tying.
You know, synthetics have a tendency to beat up your scissors really bad if you're tying a lot of, you know, bait fish patterns or. I use it mostly when I'm tying a lot of my 5-minute finger mullet pattern, which is you know, a cylindrical synthetic, you know, mullet pattern, and you can get that, you know, initial shape really fast with a rotary vise just by holding the trimmer where you want, give it a couple of spins, and you're right to where you need to be, you know.
Yeah.
Saves a lot of time, and you get a nice clean look.
And you also use a lot of markers. Are there particular different manufacturers or types of markers that you use that you like best?
You know, I used to use a lot of Sharpies, but, you know, some of the colors I love, they're discontinued, so I had to branch out and look a little bit further. Chart Pack is the one I use now. They're a wide chisel tip marker. They get a lot of ink on fast, so you got to kind of go, you know, lightly with them. But the colors are really natural. They're like an artist grade marker, I guess, if you will. They come in, you know, a lot of different variety packs and things like that. But they're fantastic. They don't have
Chart Pack.
A real. Yep. Chartpak. And, again, Hairline carries those, but they're all over any art store. They're a thick marker, and they come in just an endless array of colors.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed, I was going through a lot of the patterns. You do use a lot of Enrico Puglisi materials. You like his stuff, I take it?
Yeah, you know, for the crabs and smaller crustaceans, it's great stuff. It comes in a lot of different colors. I really prefer, probably his foxy brushes over anything for little crustaceans. They just give a really buggy look, and it's really, you know, a couple of quick turns. They're awesome. So, yeah, the 1.5 foxy brush short, I think, in a coyote or a sand or a white, you can make anything look buggy real quick. You know, it's a great material to have in your travel bag for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You You tell the story about how confusing dumbbell and bead eye chains are and so forth. So you ended up developing a matrix here of all the different kinds of eyes, 2 pages worth. I don't know how many are in each page here.
It took me about a week in a previous.
Tell the story.
Well, in a previous life, I was a consultant, so I spent a lot of time on Excel and building, you know, matrix and, you know, things that to try to explain complex, I guess, scenarios or problems or whatever. So when I stumbled on this one, you know, a guy that's been tying flies for most of his life, that couldn't figure out sizes or, you know, any kind of weight that was definitive, it just made me mad. So I started doing it more for myself, and then people would always ask me, well, I can't get this eye or this fly shop, what's similar to this one? So I finally just called all the manufacturers and told them what I was doing. I bought a gram scale and a micrometer, and I just started measuring them all and weighing them all to have, you know, the definitive answer on all of it, so I could compare and contrast all the different sizes. That are, you know, how big is a medium? You know, how much does that weigh? Some, you know, medium in one manufacturer is a small in another. So it really gave us a line of demarcation, I guess.
So how do you
benchmark, if you will?
Yeah. So what, you know, how do you use this practically?
You know, as you get into sink rates, it becomes really apparent that that's a huge issue with a lot of species, is how fast a fly is falling through the water column. So, and it's not necessarily the size eye, but the total weight or the total speed at which it moves through the water. So once you have that information, it can help you kind of get drilled in depending on what you have to work with. So no matter what fly shop you go to, one of those eyeballs is going to be on there, and it gives you a starting point. You know, for me, I tie the same fly in a few different sizes when I travel, and then, you know, it could be the salinity that could change the sink rate. It could be, you know, the materials you use, whether you use EP versus Aunt Lydia's. There's a number of different factors that can affect the sink rate of a fly. The weight that you tie on, whether the dumbbell eye or bead chain, to the hook, which is also a factor, all those things add up. So if you at least have some information on the weight that you're starting with, then you can start to figure out sink rates a little bit faster and make adjustments.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, you can see with a weight, and then, you know, do you want to double that or just have it, or, you know, depending on.
Well, the other thing is a lot of recipes call for, you know, a 5/32 brass dazzle eye. Well, what if I can't get a 5/32 brass dazzle eye? What's the next closest thing? So you can look up that size in the matrix and then say, okay, I'm going to cruise through these other ones and find one that's similar weight. And that you know, if that's what that pattern calls for, then you have a substitute.
Yeah. Good chart. And that's, it's a 3-page, two and two-thirds pages of
it was a lot. I bit off a lot with that one.
Yeah. Well, that's going to come in handy. I can see that definitely. Good. Okay. Well, I'm going to roll through some of these flies that you tie and kind of highlight them and talk about certain things you do in them, and let you kind of talk about those things as we go through. And I'm in your bonefish book and Tradella's Ghost, and a bonefish fly. Do you want to tell how this was originated, where it came from?
Well, yeah, absolutely. First, let me say that the books are laid out, just so the listeners know. Bonefish is kind of the first of the three, then tarpon, then permit, and each of the books have, much like a cookbook, they're laid out from simplest to more complex. So a lot of the things that I discuss in the book, you know, a technique or a term might be used early and not yet explained completely further in the book. So the Bonefish book is the one that has the, all the tips, tricks, and techniques up front first, and then it gets easier as it goes, or harder as it goes to the end of the book. So Trudell's ghost is one of the first flies in the book, if not the first one, and it's relatively simple. I really like this fly because it's one of the ones I teach beginners. It's basically, you know, a little bit of rabbit hair and some yarn and a dog brush to comb it out. But it's a really effective pattern. You can weight it heavily for, like, mudding fish if you're in the Bahamas or wherever, Belize, and you need to have a deep water fly. That's one I really like. The other one's a Simram or whatever. That's what most folks bring, but that's a little bit more difficult fly to tie. This fly, like I said, is a little bit of rabbit hair and maybe a strand of crystal flash or two, and just some craft yarn that you can find.
Yeah.
And all the fibers make the body. So that's a super easy one.
One thing you do when you start out doing it here, and you do it consistently throughout the books, is to double over material and to tie it on. So in other words, we'll tell how you tie the crystal flash. It's really simple, but I think it's such a good technique.
So that technique I use for a couple of reasons. One, I don't like tying in bare tips for near the eye of the hook. So anytime you can double over a material, you're going to make a much cleaner thread wrap. You don't have to try to lash down, you know, tips of deer hair or anything, you know, anything you can bend over, it's going to be a lot cleaner. So I always double over, like, flash or longer synthetics. So it's cleaner, but so after a few fish, they don't pull out. If there's only, you know, four or five thread wraps on an eighth of an inch of material, they have a tendency to work themselves loose. So it's, you know, twofold. One, to keep it more durable, and two, to give you a cleaner fly.
Yeah, and by doubling over, you mean just taking one strand, putting the thread through the middle, and then folding it. Yeah.
Yeah, so what I do is, and it also gives you more uniform flies on each side of the hook. So what I'll do is I'll grab one end of, let's say, a couple of strands of crystal flash with my index finger and thumb, and then I'll wrap it behind the hanging thread, and then I'll grab the other end with my ring finger and middle finger, and then I make kind of a V. And the point of the V is, you know, touching the shank of the hook and secured in place by single thread wrap, and then you can wrap over both legs, makes the fly uniform. You can measure up the material evenly on both sides of the hook, and then lash it down on the hook. It'll also help you position where it is on the sides of the fly. So if you're trying to tie a lateral line or something like that, you don't have one pointing down and one pointing up.
All right. Yeah, good technique. Listen, we got to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll dig into more Drew's flies and fly tying techniques. So hang with us, and we'll be right back. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They've been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, it's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Drew Chacon about top saltwater flies. If you'd like to ask Drew a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight. So, Drew, I always ask, I see there was a follow-up question here before I dive in. Somebody wrote in, wants to know the name of the glue. It was E6000, Treg. So just to clear that up. Okay. I was asking my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Obviously, you know, finishing this three-volume set was a huge undertaking. So I'm glad you're having a bit of a rest. But happening?
Since I finished these, I came out with another book, Largemouth Bass Flies. I guess there's no rest for the wicked. That happened. Been doing a lot of bass fishing with my daughter, so I figured it was just kind of next on the list. Not saltwater, but I had to get it done for all the bass fans out there. I just joined Patagonia as a fly fishing ambassador for them, so that's a big deal for me. I'm looking forward to working with them on a bunch of upcoming stuff. What else? I've been working with the American Museum of Fly Fishing. That's been pretty amazing. I went up to Vermont and went to the museum and saw their new saltwater exposition. That's awesome. It's just been a busy summer.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. Well, good, good. And everybody, to follow what Drew's doing, Drew, you want to tell us your domain name again, your website?
Yeah, it's saltyflytying.com is my website. Most of my activity these days is on Instagram. I do still post through to Facebook, and you can see some of my stuff on Twitter. But if you're interested in the latest flies and patterns and stuff that I'm doing in my newsletter, check out my Instagram page, Dr. Chicone, D-R-C-H-I-C-O-N-E.
Okay, good, good. All right. Well, thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, no problem.
Another one that popped up here for me was Chicone's Bon Appetit.
Yep.
And notes I made there was Arctic fox fur versus rabbit. You want to tell us, and you discussed fouling and movement and so forth. You want to talk about those two materials? Because those, a lot of people use rabbit for sure. So what's the advantages?
Well, you know, it's 6 of 1, half dozen the other, what you can get, what you like. Arctic fox is a little bit softer. It tends to be longer. So if you need to use a natural fiber that has a lot of, you know, movement in the water, it's really soft. Rabbit and Arctic fox are both great choices, but Arctic fox allows you to tie a larger fly. Not to muddy the water anymore, but another one I found is the thin raccoon, which has guard hairs, which makes it a little bit stiffer yet. So sometimes there's this, you know, I guess paradox between stuff that looks great and moves well in the water and the same material fouling. So you need a little bit more rigidity, but when you go that route, you lose the mobility in the water. So there's, for short stuff, I go with rabbit, kind of the medium grade, it's Arctic fox, and then real long stuff, I'm going with fin raccoon or coyote or something like that. It just depends on the colors you're looking for and the texture, which is a big thing, you know, on like bonefish flies or permit flies, you're not moving them a whole lot. So if you stop them, you want them to move on their own.
Yeah. Now, where do you get rabbit's pretty readily available. The Arctic fox and the Finnish raccoon. And where are you? What's your sources for that?
Most everything I get these days is through Hairline Dub.
Oh, Okay.
Saltwater Fly Tire, I think it's out of St. Pete. Those guys do some custom colors on Finn Raccoon that's just unbelievable. So check out that site.
What is it again? Saltwater
Fly Tires. Saltwater Fly Tires, I think, and you might be able to get to it through Oyster Creek Outfitters as well. It's just awesome. There's a shrimp pink, fin raccoon, and a electric yellow that I use a lot for snook and tarpon. Yeah, give those guys a shout or check that out. If you haven't, you know, if you can't seem to get to it, shoot me an email. I'll happy to give you a link if I'm not saying it correctly or, you know, there's some kind of break in trying to get to it.
Yeah, I just searched it, Saltwater Fly Tires, TYERS.com, and it's Oyster Creek Outfitters.
They have just an awesome, variety of custom dyed stuff. For everything else, I get it from Hairline. They just have the best selection.
Have everything you need, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah, good. This one, Chacon's Tranquilizer Shrimp.
Yep.
Tranquilizer Shrimp. What struck me about that is you talk about inner glow on a fly. Getting that, you know, that transparent inner glow on the fly. And this, I thought, was a good example of that. You want to explain the goal the method? Yeah.
So Dick Brown, who's like the guru of bonefish flies, came up with that technique, I think. I think he's credited with inventing it. And that's putting a UV-reactive material underneath a veil of transparent material. So what happens is you get kind of this glow from underneath once it gets wet of a brighter color passing through like a transparent or opaque material, which makes it look alive or very realistic. So I liked that technique with the style of Henry Collins' shrimp scampi, or bonefish scampi, I think it's called, his pattern, which is the zonker strip on top. So, you know, a lot of times you take your favorite parts of two or three different flies, and that ends up becoming something else, and that's the prime example. It was just an attractor pattern that was very heavy that we used in Andros, kind of test and tweaked it there. And we couldn't find a fly that was, you know, getting the attention of these big fish. So I just started tying up the brightest stuff I could get. We used, you know, neon red legs and, you know, the brightest thread and, you know, just a massive fly. And we tightened the screws over a few times of being down there. The name came from, at the time we were staying at Tranquility Hill Lodge. So that's where it comes from. But, just a really bright pattern, which kind of goes against, you know, the conventional bonefish fly. You know, most of the stuff I fish in the middle of the day is like void of color or, you know, just soft pinks or a little pop of orange here or there. But this was kind of the turn on the spotlight. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. Because, you know, when you actually... It's fun to go out there and try to get the shrimp and the crabs and stuff to see what they actually look like. And then you begin to see, you know, what you're really trying to simulate. And not so easily done many times. But
you know, it's funny. You think that a lot of these flies are just attractor patterns, and then you're walking on a flat and you see a neon orange mantis shrimp, and you can hardly believe your eyes. But, they're out there.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Let's see. Let me see if I can grab this one. I think it was in Let's see here. Yeah, the Helms Jesse special. I think you were talking about Zonker strips and how you handle the maybe it wasn't that one, but anyway, how you get the hair off the Zonker strips and it, to use
it was it was in the interview with Chris Helm. Chris Helm was probably one of the best fly tires I ever had the pleasure of learning from. He was an amazing wealth of knowledge, and he showed me that technique when he was tying his Simram variation. And what he did was cut the leather off a Zonker strip, and then he used a clip or, you know, like a bulldog clip to secure the hair, cut the strip away, and then put it in a dubbing loop to reduce the weight. Instead of palmering the Zonker strip around the hook, which usually gets saturated and makes the changes the fly sink rate, makes it kind of come down with a splat, and it's just a lot clunkier way of doing it. He cut it off and built the collar out of a dubbing loop made with just the rabbit hair, and that's how I came up with the idea for reducing the weight on my Tuscan Bunny fly, was using that technique.
Yeah, I thought that was really slick how the clip, you know, big, you know, a bulldog clip is just like one of those big paper clip things that can grab a, what do you use, like a four-inch wide one or something?
Yeah, 3 or 4 inches, which is there, it's got a kind of a flat jaw, so it holds the hair perfectly. And when you trim it, usually there's about an eighth of an inch between the metal and the cut ends of the hair. And that's what you can slide into the loop. If not, you kind of just open it lightly, stacked on your bench, and give yourself a little bit more room to work with. But, yeah, it's a fantastic tool. And that technique I use all the time for all kinds of different patterns.
Another one here, Chacon's Drama Queen Shrimp. And the material you use there, I believe, is your material, Crusher Legs.
So
how did that come about?
Well,
and why do you use it?
When I was in the Bahamas, I realized that all those little crustaceans that we were trying to find were pretty much clear, or if they did have any color, it was just, you know, little dots or scan them out here or there, little pops of color. And in all the rubber legs on the market at the time that were barred black over a color, black over olive, black over tan, or, you know, black, even black and orange, but it was a solid orange leg with black bars on it. So you lost all that translucency. So I called my buddies at Hairline and said, hey, is there any way we can do a barred leg over clear? You know, I want the bar to be the actual color so it looks more realistic in the water. And that's what they did. We worked, you know, come up with a bunch of different colors of that. And then in order to create a fly that's body was that matched, the body matched the legs, clear with a little bit of color, we cut that leg in a few different sizes. So the wide allows you to use it, the rubber leg, like vinyl ribs. So you can palmer it around the shank of the hook and create a body, and then use a couple of different sizes of legs to give it a more realistic look instead of it all being uniform.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that material is available from you directly, right, or is it through Hairline?
You can get it at most any fly shop now. They're all, it's all over the place. Again, Hairline supplies most of the fly shops now. I think they bought Spirit River, so they're everywhere. So, if you can't find it there, you can get them from me on my website. If you can't find them in your local fly shop, I sell them on my website as well.
Yeah. Boy, we're getting a lot of – I'm going to have to start fielding some of these questions here. We've got a bunch of them coming in, Drew, on the Internet. So, And then we had some that were sent in as well. So let me try to grab some of these here.
Sure.
I'm going to hit some of these that came in early. Alan Rupp, New York City. Do you feel that having the proper fly is more important than making the proper presentation?
In a lot of situations, I'd say yes. If the fish are turned on and you make a poor presentation, like, for example, with snook, it doesn't matter how great the fly is. If you draw the fly towards the fish, it's like a gazelle chasing a lion, and they freak out. So it's better to have a curve cast or a cast short that as you draw the fly away from the fish, they're going to eat it. In other hands, you know, I've been in situations where they would not eat four flies, and on the fifth fly, once we got it dialed into the size and with the color and the sink rate, you know, saved the day. We caught, you know, an unthinkable amount of fish just by having the right fly. So six of one, half dozen the other.
Yeah. Stefan in Ellensburg, Washington writes, what do you think is the most effective way to deal with bonefish selectivity on flats that are fished frequently in places such as the Bahamas, Belize, or Christmas Island? Would you try to present a new fly patterns or tie proven patterns with different materials or dial down your presentation?
Okay, so a lot of times what I do is it depends first on what time of day you're fishing. So early morning, I will go with brighter colors, and if they don't eat, then I go smaller. In the middle of the day, I will start with more muted colors, and same thing, scale down. If you're still getting refusals, then I'll start to go down in leader size and up in leader length. So I might go down to like an 8-pound bite tippet and go to a 14-foot leader. But for the most part, with real spooky fish, I try to go more sparse and less color, so more natural things, more natural materials. If you look at most of the crabs and shrimp that you find on the flats, they're trying to hide. They blend in really well. There might be just an itty bit of color on them. A lot of times I'll go completely tan, but I'll just put like a black and white barred leg in there. That's just something that I found works really well. Most crabs have a little checkered spot on their swim fin, on their swimmers. It's black and white, so I'll go all tan with just a one black and white silly leg in there.
Yeah, okay. We have Roy Fukushima in Orange, California. I fish for bonefish on shallow flats with coral, smoothed over rocks, and matted spongy seaweed, and wondering what shrimp flies you would suggest that don't snag easily. Can be very frustrating when making that perfect presentation only to have your fly get stuck on the bottom terrain. Yep, common problem.
Okay. Yes. The first thing I do is I tend to get rid of the weight if you're fishing really shallow or anything that's going to hang up on the bottom. All my flies, I start with weed guards for the most part in Florida. When I get to the Bahamas, I'm in, you know, gin clear water. I might not put them on bonefish flies, but I find that it's easier to cut them off. So I use a piece of 20-pound hard mason to keep the flies weedless, and it also helps if there's a lot of debris to do a double weed guard with no weight. The mono floats will help correct the fly hook point up, but you can also, like with my coyote ugly shrimp, you can leave it a little bit larger as you trim the body of the fly, and that will help you keep the actual hook off the bottom, if that makes sense. So for stuff that's, I guess, a lot of coral or a lot of materials, you might even be able to go to like a bendback old school style bonefish fly. I think it's called, you'd say that it's something queen. Just, you know, before we got into this, all the bead chain, you know, classic Charlie gotcha style, a lot of guys fish like a Bailey snapping shrimp is an awesome pattern for bonefish, and that's a bend back style fly. So give that a try too if you're having issues with it getting hung up.
Yeah, that one I had my page turned to that one. So, yeah, Bailey snapping shrimp. Let me ask you, since you brought that up, a question about that. That uses Aunt Lydia's rug yarn. And
yep.
You say it's no longer available. You must have quite the stash down there, I suppose.
it's a treasure trove. Anytime I find it in the I offer it on my website simply because I'm always surfing the old interweb trying to find it, or, you know, you go to a yard sale or something or one of these places, and you can find it. I buy all I can get. It's probably the best synthetic material for doing merkin style, you know, perpendicular to the hook shank. It's just really, really coarse. There's a little bit of natural sparkle to it, so it's awesome. You can still find it once in a while on eBay, but again, you got to buy like a whole skein of it. So if you're looking for smaller quantities, you know, tan or olive, I have the more normal or more fishy colors, I think, on my, I'll buy as much as I can get. But yeah, it's awesome stuff. And the technique that Bailey, Steve showed me was, you know, he spins it in like an old blender and then makes dubbing out of it. And it's just amazing. It's like, it almost gives your flies like a natural crunchiness to them. It's kind of bizarre, but it's very coarse. Yeah. Very, very cool stuff to work with.
Yeah. 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 So keep searching on that. And you said you haven't found an alternative, but I mean, at someday there's not going to be any more anywhere, right? So
EP, like the regular EP fibers, they have the same translucency, but they don't have the stiffness and coarseness. And a lot of the old time permit guys say that EP flies don't sink the same way that an Aunt Lydia fly would sink because the way it's furled. So when you tie in a furled piece of synthetic, it's stiffer at the tie-in point. So it creates a wider profile, and it doesn't unravel. So if you tie in already unraveled fibers like EP, which is just, you know, multiple fibers, the water passes through that faster than a furled fiber. So the sink rate's different on a merkin tied with EP than it is with Aunt Lydia's.
Have you talked to Enrico about creating a substitute?
I have not talked to Enrico about that.
I'm going to probably talk to him tomorrow. I'll ask him.
Yeah. It'll be the new Roger synthetic, Roger Mays synthetic. Roger's rug yarn.
He's coming out with a bunch of new material, and so, you know, why not ask him? Hey, he's got the
absolutely
stuff. Yeah.
More the merrier.
There's your challenge, Enrico.
That's it.
Yeah. We had Brian Daly in Canton, Georgia. He says, how important do you think it is to carry duplicates of flies when traveling to a new saltwater destination? I find myself paring down in order to have a wide variety of offerings instead of going 4 to 5 deep in all sizes of some patterns.
Well, that's an important one for me. A good question. I always recommend bringing at least 3 of any pattern you're going to put in your box, because what inevitably happens is you stumble upon a hot one, and you're always fishing with a buddy that's going to take one off you. Now you're down to 2, and you break one off.
And the guide wants one too, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And so I would say unfortunately, I err on both sides, where I bring about 15 patterns, about 5 deep of each. So, you know, it's ridiculous. 90% of the flies never see the light of day, but I bring them with me anyways and give them away at the lodge.
Sure.
Yeah, I would say absolutely tie at least 3 of any of the flies that you're going to put in your box and go with. And usually what I do is I stage tie. So I'll lay out, you know, 12 number 4s and 12 number 6s, and then I'll put out, you know, the accompanying medium and small bead chain, And I tie all that first, and then I do, you know, each fly in two sizes, two sink rates, you know, three or four deep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know a lot of what I do is take smaller boxes, you know, out fishing, but always have back at the lodge, you know, a big box of, you know, a lot of inventory. So I can replenish.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the lightest part of your travel anyway, you know, so. You know,
I don't even use boxes anymore. I use a Patagonia cube, which is what they recommend for traveling with to put clothes in. It zips flat, and there's two sides to it. And
mm-hmm.
I put, like, leader material and, you know, a dog brush and a pair of snippers or whatever in there, a hook file in one side, and with some flies on the other side, I put some flies in there, and I keep them all in, like, little baggies, and, you know, because
mm-hmm.
inevitably something gets, you know, they all get wet, and then the whole box is ruined, and I've done that so
right.
many times, or the box blows off, so now, you know, I use that soft-sided bag, which I can stuff into another bag or into a hatch, and they're all waterproof, every individual fly.
Yeah, yeah, good idea, yeah. Let's see here. We've got let's take a couple off the internet. Ed Weston wants to know, do you make your own brushes?
Dubbing brushes or dog
yeah.
brushes?
No, I make dubbing
my...
brushes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I bought an electric dubbing brush machine many moons ago, and I haven't been able to find them since. And I do most of my synthetics in that. If I'm doing really big flies, like big mullet patterns or collars for tarpon toads, I'll spin up Arctic fox in there if I want, like, custom colors, you know, that's not available. But absolutely, I do a lot of brushes.
Still there?
I'm here, yep.
Okay. I heard a beep, so I'm got a little freaked out there for a second. when you said you had an order to your books, it was bonefish, tarpon, and then permit? Is that?
Yep.
Yeah, as far as difficulty of tying? Okay.
Well, I don't know if they're all laid out from easiest to most difficult. And
within
the
books themselves, right?
Yeah, within the books. And then bonefish is kind of the tips, tricks, and technique is the first chapter in that book. So
right,
you could
right.
go from bonefish to tarpon or bonefish to permit. That really wouldn't make too much of a difference, but yes,
yeah.
absolutely, throughout
yeah.
the books.
Yeah. One thing you used, Chacon's peyote paolo worm.
Yep.
What is it? Palolo worm.
Palolo worm, yep.
Palala worm.
That's those worms that hatch down in the Keys or all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, you use a pasta cutter in that.
Yeah.
Explain to folks.
That's how the Tuscan bunny came to light, and now I got sick of doing that. My wife's got her pasta cutter back. The guys at Hairline do my fettuccine foam, but that's how I came up with the name Tuscan Bunny. Was I ran sheets of foam through the pasta cutter to give me strips that allowed me to, you know, spin it like deer hair, and then I could adjust the buoyancy by increasing or decreasing the amount of foam. And foam doesn't saturate like deer hair, so that's where the strip foam came from. And then as I had strip foam around all the time, I just started coming up with other patterns, and that the pattern you're talking about, the palala worm, is basically a strip of foam that keeps the fly up real high in the water, and then the palmered body pushes water and you know, makes a disturbance on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you just ran the foam through the pasta cutter to get the strips.
Right? Yep,
and,
you got it. Yeah, now you can just buy it, you know, it's called Chacon's Fettuccine Foam, and it comes in, you know, I don't know how many colors, but the usual more options than you know what to do with. But I use that strip foam, the fettuccine foam, for Tuscan bunny, my king rat, the Palalo worm, you name it. I'm finding more uses for it every day.
Yeah, since you brought up the Tuscan bunny, that's a very unique pattern and unique use of the foam there. Can you tell people about how that came about and how you tied it?
Yeah,
pardon me?
The beginning of it all was, the Tuscan bunny was kind of the, if I had to give up all fish, I guess, and only take one, it'd be snook. That's my favorite. They're the fish that keep me up at night. And where I live in Fort Myers, Florida, in April, May, June, those big girls are coming out of the river and floating around in, you know, a couple feet of water. So it's really difficult to put a cast on them without spooking them. It's better if you can have the fly where they're going to be. So you're making a, you know, 60, 70 foot cast, getting way off them so they don't see you, because the water is shallow, and the fly has to be neutrally buoyant and not sink, but you don't want it to float. So if you use deer hair, like the old swamp bunny, which I love, after a few casts, the fly would saturate, and it would lose its buoyancy and sink, and it would also come down like a wet blanket. It just splat, and that would spook a lot of fish. So the conundrum was trying to come up with a fly that would ride in the water column where you want it to be and come down soft and still be castable. So the fettuccine foam allowed me to adjust the buoyancy or where that fly would ride in the water column with, you know, a hook heavy enough to fight a 40-inch snook on and be able to adjust it. So, you know, like 11 strips of foam on a 2-aught, you know, owner fly liner, what was the magic number? If you want to ride higher or you want to change the hook out, you can simply adjust it by adjusting up or down the strip foam, and the foam doesn't saturate. Also, when you trim it, those trimmed ends push a lot of water, so you get a really lifelike movement out of the tail as you're moving the water across all those different nubby ends, which makes the rabbit zonker strip tail swim. So that was how I came up with that bug, and why the Tuscan, or the bunny, got its name, was using the pasta cutter to cut sheet foam.
Cut the foam.
I was at a restaurant with my wife, and I watched the guy run pasta through the machine, and it just kind of clicked. And I said to my wife, "We got to go home. I got to do something with the pasta cutter at the house." So.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Good use of it. Question came in on the internet from Greg Owings, I think, hold on. Yeah, Greg Owings in Moscow, Idaho. He says, do you use yak hair for its ability to shed water? And I know I had marked here Chacon's micro mangrove cannibal that you use yak hair in. So want to talk about hair a little bit?
I use a lot of yak hair. That, for a long time, still is one of my favorite materials, especially for big bait fish patterns. Not only does it, shed water, but it does saturate a little bit where it gets a little more supple and it'll move, where a synthetic won't do that. It doesn't trap air, so when you do put a cast on a cruising fish, you don't have to strip 4 or 5 times to break through the surface tension to get the fly underwater. But also, it's one of the only natural fibers that you can get that length on without tips. So I can create any length or size bait fish fly by tapering it and then doubling it over on itself, where, you know, you're limited to the length of the hair or fiber. If you use deer hair or something like that, you just can't make a really big fly. So what I found is, in the summer or spring, you know, June, July, on the beaches when we're targeting, you know, cruising snook on like Sanibel and Captiva, I find they eat a really big, you know, 5-6 inch bait fish pattern better than, you know, a little itty bitty one sometimes. So I started creating really big bait fish that were void of color, like translucent. Everything on the beach that time of year is washed out. The sand's white. So I started tying with yak hair because it had those translucent qualities, and I could create a really big bait fish that looked really natural. Also, another attribute, which I get a lot of flack from my buddies, is that you can count the fibers. And the reason I do that is, one, primarily for teaching. So what I found was you couldn't illustrate how much material to use effectively by saying a pencil width or a matchstick or whatever measurement, you know, because no one seemed to know what that was. So if you counted out 80 strands of yak hair, which is way easier than you think, you know the measurement. And after you had done it a couple of times, you know about how much material to use. And it makes blending colors a lot easier, too. If you say 20 gray, 10 tan, and 5 turquoise, you know your fly is going to be right on the money every time, and you can reproduce that.
Good. Another fur hair you use is coyote. Chacon's Calypso Coyote, and tell us why that's an important component.
I kind of stumbled on when I got my sentence to fly fishing purgatory in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. My wife had to take a job in Scottsdale, so we moved there for a couple of years, and it was just material that was around everywhere. You know, we had coyotes in the side yard. You'd keep the dogs inside kind of a thing. And one of my buddies had a hunting show, and I got to go out with him a few times. And I got to really look at the material, the fur, and it had a lot of really diverse natural color tones that pretty much mimic the bottom of, you know, like in the Bahamas or Belize, like creams, dark browns, grays. So the diversity of color in coyote fur just lend itself towards tying crustacean patterns. It's also coarse, but, you know, it has some movement to it. So it's just a great material for tying bonefish and permit flies. I use it all the time, even on some of my tarpon flies, like you mentioned.
Okay. Rob in Savannah, this one came in on the internet. In Featherbrain, he says, you discuss UV reflective materials and their advantages, especially in low light conditions. Can you please expand on this? Are there certain species of fish that are more reactive to UV? Good question.
Yeah, so UV reactive versus UV reflective is kind of a hot topic. A lot of the materials you find now that are sold, say, like dyed UV reactive, and basically UV colors are more visible in low light. So even with, I think it's distance underwater down, but also like lengthwise, UV light can, or reactive colors and light can be seen further. So when you're fishing in low light, a UV reactive color, because there's always going to be UV light, if there's any light, is going to be seen much further than any other color. So that when you're using like hot pinks, chartreuse, colors that have a very high UV reactivity, they're going to be seen at a lot further distance, much like when you see a road worker wearing chartreuse or blaze orange. It's the same thing. So a lot of times you're going to get noticed from a fish that you wouldn't by using a more muted tone. So UV reactive colors have a tendency to be used as attractors. And I talk about in the book with the different color spectrum with like feathers. Feathers have are UV reflective. So like white has a higher white feathers are more UV reflective than black. And like they, you know, there's fish like they've done a lot of testing on salmon and like the fry and the cones and rods. I mean, obviously what they see, obviously you're never truly going to know what a fish sees, but they're testing the fish's, I guess, reactivity, or do they react to these UV color spectrums or UV indicators in the water. So there's a whole science to it. I don't claim to be the, you know, Bill Nye, the science guy and all this stuff, but I did my best to explain its usefulness as far as tying flies with UV colors as attractors.
Okay. Greg Owens, Wings, in Moscow, Idaho, had another comment question here. He said when he went to Christmas Island, the guides there pulled the rubber legs off most of his flies. So he wants to know what you think of rubber legs. Have you been Christmas Island or know of that guide?
I haven't, but no matter where I go in the world, the guides always look in my box and say, none of this crap's going to work. That's pretty much the standard. And on the last day, they always say, I don't want a tip. Can I just have your flies? So I don't know if that's how they haze people that like to tie flies or what, but you know, I can see if maybe the fly is too big or they don't like you know, it's too bright. That, you know, I've never had a guide pull any of the rubber legs off my flies. Maybe it was the color. Try tying with those crusher legs. They're clear with a little bit of color. I don't know. I've never experienced that, but I would say, you know, the best thing you can do is make your own deductions from fishing the fly.
Yeah.
And if you get a lot of refusals, then start adjusting.
You never
know what's going to be the next hot fly.
Yeah, a couple of questions here from Jay Murakoshi. Jay is on our show, too. He does a lot of guiding down in Baja. He wanted to know, what colors of Lydia rugyan are popular? He says, I have a bunch of skeins of different colors stashed away.
Yeah, you know, my favorite ones probably are the brown tones and the green tones. So beige, antique gold, cream, those are really good for like kind of natural browns. There's a flaxseed, I think it's called. There's I can probably just pull them out from underneath my bench here, but grass green. So, yeah, I would say the greens and the tans are going to be the – also purple and black. Those are your other two saltwater colors.
He also asks, Jay also asks, is your dubbing machine from Roots?
No, I got my dubbing machine maybe – I don't know how long ago, but I got it from the Grizzly Hackle in Montana. There was a guy online named Drew, surprisingly enough, selling them. And I emailed him, and he said, yeah, we got one or two left. And, you know, that was the last I'd ever seen him. I bought this one. I've talked to a lot of people about manufacturing them for me. And, you know, it's based – mine has a spring-loaded – cup hook on the far end, and then the near side on the motor is just another cup hook, and there's a drop away aluminum tray. So you affix the wire to the machine side cup hook, then you wrap the wire around the far cup hook, And let it hang, and then raise the tray up to the wire. You load the tray up with whatever you want to be in that big, you know, dubbing brush or basically a pipe cleaner. And then you put the other leg across when you're done of the wire, put it over the loop, and then fire it up. Cut away the wire and spin it and dog brushing it out. That's how I make them. But, you know, there's a lot of dubbing brush machines out there, but they're not electric. And it makes a big difference if you can get your paws on an electric one.
One final question, because I know you guys have been suffering down there in Fort Myers, Sanibel area with the red tide. Phil McCartney asked how the snook population is doing down there in your area.
Well, we were doing better until a couple of days ago, and it popped back up. And I don't know if you've seen the pictures on Instagram and Facebook, but we had another big kill up near Captiva. So, you know, it's hard to say. I know it's, you know, something that happens. Red tide isn't the first time it's ever happened. You know, we have red tide. This year's obviously been way more severe, and it's just, it's tough to watch, but.
There's a lot of stuff floating up that
shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll clear up here soon for you guys. And
Anyway,
we're all thinking about you down there, because nobody likes to see a fish
right
up to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, time to wrap this up, Drew. It went by so fast, I can't believe it. I still had like 40 more questions for you.
Guess we're going to have to do another show.
Yeah, and people have to get your books if they want to find out all your secrets. So,
That's it.
And you've documented most of your successes as per all the books you have. So, it's all out there. But hey, everybody, stick with me just a few more minutes. We're going to give away a 1-year membership to the Fly Fishers International, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and a copy of Drew's book Featherbrain, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So. Stick with us a few more minutes, and we're going to give away those prizes, and maybe you'll be a winner. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org, and there you can learn more about how to about what's going on and how to get involved. Again, that's SaveBristolBay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, take a minute, give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. Winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show. You don't want to miss out on the chance to get one of these great prizes we have to offer. So the lucky winner will contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your prize. So, that's how that works. The first thing we're going to do is give away that 1-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. Flyfishersinternational.org. Great organization to be part of and support, so check them out. Our winner for that is Tom Berry in Ohio. Tom Berry. So congratulations, Tom, on your membership to Fly Fishers International. And our second prize we're going to give away is a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. Amato has several different periodicals and also many books on fly fishing that should interest you, so check them out as well. Our winner for that is Joe Andrzejczyk in Texas. So congratulations, Joe, on your subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. I'm sure you'll enjoy that as well. Okay, now we'll give away Drew's book, Feather Brain, Developing, Testing, and Improving Saltwater Fly Patterns. And great book to have in your library as well. And I'll try to talk Drew into maybe doing another show in a few months, and we'll explore Feather Brain. So, you up for that, Drew?
Happy to do it, anytime.
Okay, good, good. So the question for this tonight is, we talked about a lot of fur and hair. Name three types of fur or hair that Drew uses for his flies, but not rabbit. Rabbit doesn't count. So we talked three or four of these. Give me three of them, and you'll get Drew's book. So, not quite Treg, but good try. Treg Owings put so many things in his answer ahead of time that he was hoping that he'd get it. He got part of it, but not what I had really asked. So we'll keep trying for another one. Okay, he submitted another answer. So here's what he said. Arctic fox, Finnish raccoon, and yak. So those are three of the ones.
That sounds like a winner to me.
Yeah, it sounds like a winner to me, too. So congratulations, Treg. And just don't tie any of those rubber legs on your flies next time you go to Christmas Island. You know, what a waste of material.
Yeah.
Or try Drew's legs, those crusher legs. Maybe they'll like those better. So anyway, Treg, it's been a while. Send me your address, and we'll get Stackpole to send you out a book. And
can't buy them there. They were probably taking them for themselves.
There you go. Sticking them in their pocket, huh? Yeah.
That's it. You don't need these rubber legs.
I don't think you can buy anything on Christmas Island, you know.
That's what I'm saying. Limited supply, right?
Yeah. Well, good. Hey, Drew, it's great having you on the show. Like I said, it just flew by, and lots of fun talking to you about fly tying, and we'll have to do it again sometime. But thanks again for sharing your knowledge with us.
My pleasure. It was great speaking with you tonight. Take care.
All right. Folks, if you haven't discovered the archive on our website, check it out. We did put up a new website this past week, so lots of new things there. You can find Drew's books there on our homepage, and so if you want to check one of those books out, go for it, and we'll send you right to the page to get those. And, you know, we've done, I think, over 185 shows now and Ask About Fly Fishing, so use the archive, do some keyword searches, and you'll be amazed at all the education and information we have on the website. Our next broadcast will be October 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'm going to interview John Garrick. And the topic for the show will be fly fishing writing and stories. John has been writing about fly fishing for most of his life. He's the author of 21 books, including Trout Bum, Sex, Death, and Fly Fishing, Standing in a River Waving a Stick, and A Fly Rod of Your Own. So join us for a chat with John about his writing, inspiration, and, of course, fly fishing. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.